Hot. Bring the heat.
And now, your host, Pat Rouleau.
Welcome to Speak Up Talk Radio. This program gets behind the environmental, social, political, educational, spiritual, and health decisions that affect our lives and futures, yet are not always determined by us, but rather by politics, business, and other self-interest groups. Investigative in nature, we go where mainstream stops. As a leader in the healthcare and patient safety world, I now expose current and relevant harms and charms that either endanger or improve our health, our freedom, our privacy, and our sanity. Most of us simply don't have time to pay attention to decisions that are being made on our behalf, decisions made by people who may have less than altruistic motives. And often we don't speak up because we are not aware. Well, this program changes that by being the voice for informed choice. I am your hostess, Pat Rouleau. So happy that we're together once again. And as usual, I have lots to share today. So let's get started, shall we? Well, today I have some interesting history on two topics, one related to our privacy and the other related to our health. It's always valuable to look at the past and follow the yellow brick road to find out how in the world we've landed in Oz. I've been talking about privacy, or the lack of, these past few weeks, because there is just so darn much going on that most people simply don't know about, or if they do hear about it, choose not to believe. Well, this past week, I happened to find out about how the government used cats as surveillance tools that had a catastrophic ending. Well, it caught my eye because I am now on the verge of becoming the crazy cat lady, as I have rescued 11 feral cats on my property, who, by the way, are no longer feral, but rather the sweetest, most loving little creatures you can imagine. I also got pulled into a battle in Mentor, Ohio, when some folks in that area contacted me about their city council wanting to approve an ordinance that considers feral cats a nuisance animal and makes any person who feeds or harbors these poor souls susceptible to misdemeanor charges. The powers that be claim that they've done the research, that by not feeding these animals, they'll simply go away. Sure, they may not stay at your house, but they'll go somewhere else down the road to find food, all the while still mating and creating more cats. A simple trap, neuter, and return approach solves the problem of breeding cats, and eventually, because no one can reproduce, the colony begins to diminish. No starving or inhumane actions needed. Well, apparently compassion is not a requirement to get elected to make decisions for the masses. Anyway, all of this cat talk made me decide to share a bit of historical background on how not only local officials, but the federal government also has little compassion for animals. Here we go.
Ready.
A report from 1967 shows that the CIA spent millions of dollars in an attempt to train domesticated cats to spy on the Soviet Union. Yes, you heard that correctly. Nicknamed Acoustic Kitty, the program involved implanting electronic spying equipment into live cats and then training them to eavesdrop on unsuspected Cold War rivals. Now, if you don't believe that this ridiculous program existed, you can read more about it online, and it is published by the National Security Archive. At the height of the Cold War, officials in the United States hatched a covert plan to keep tabs on Russians in Washington, D.C. They decided, to deploy surveillance cats. Yes, actual cats, surgically implanted with microphones and radio transmitters to slip by security and eavesdrop on activity at the Soviet embassy. Perhaps they thought that when most people see a cat, they will pet it and not assume it's a spy. For these reasons, the CIA put a 3/4-inch transmitter in a female gray and white cat. They then hid a microphone in its ear canal and had the antenna run along its back all the way to the tip of its tail. And it took some time to get each component just right, as they had to make sure that the cat had full mobility and didn't lick or scratch at the audio devices hidden inside it. The hard part was training the cat to follow directions. And if you have ever owned a cat or have been around a cat for any length of time, you know that getting a cat to do anything other than what it wants to do is nothing short of amazing. Well, after 5 years of training and $20 million later, the CIA felt they could get their special cat agent to move in specific directions and go to specific locations on command, as long as it didn't get distracted, bored, or hungry, which for a small cat is almost all the time. Nonetheless, they decided to field test their $20 million highly trained acoustic kitty agent. They drove a van across the street from a known Soviet meeting place in Washington, D.C. The target were two men sitting on a bench in a nearby park. They opened the door and deployed their secret kitty agent. The feline agent took a few steps and was hit and killed by a passing taxicab. Needless to say, it was a catastrophe. And the Acoustic Kitty project was then scrapped and was called a complete failure. Now, how sad. As if a cat life doesn't matter. Well, thank goodness it didn't work, because think of the thousands of cats running around with surveillance equipment. Maybe that's what's going on in Mentor. Surveillance cats. Maybe I'd better check mine before I speak too soon. Oh my, crazy stuff. Well, here are some bonus facts that show the government preoccupation with spy animals with little regard for life. During World War II, the military paid behavioral psychologist B.F. Skinner $25,000 to train pigeons to guide missiles to their targets. It involved putting pigeons inside a missile, and with a camera on the front of the missile, the bird could see where it was going on a small screen inside. It would then peck at the screen when the missile would drift off course from where the pigeon was trained to go. However, this was scrapped because government officials just couldn't get past the ridiculousness of it. Oh my gosh, neither can I, although I'm sure that's not why it got scrapped. Well, here's another bonus animal spy fact. Bat bombs. Yes, you heard me. Bat bombs were another experimental weapon considered by the U.S. during World War II. These bombs consisted of a bomb-shaped casing with several compartments inside. Each compartment housed a Mexican free-tailed bat, and each bat had a small device attached to it. The casings were refrigerated in order to lower the bat's body temperature and force them into hibernation until they were dropped from a plane shortly before dawn. A parachute would slow the descent, and eventually the casing would be triggered to open and release the bats. When in sunlight, bats would seek roosts in dark places like attics, so when they were released and the sun came out, they'd seek out such places. The hope was that, with the bombs timed to go off all at once, this would start fires in places that were hard to access to fight a fire. Further, in many cases, the fire's existence wouldn't be noticed until it had well established itself. It was thought that bat bombs would be particularly effective in Japan, where buildings were made largely of wood and paper. I mean, release several hundred thousands of these bats in major Japanese cities and the towns would go up in flames. Now, while on the surface this plan may seem far-fetched, the U.S. agreed to develop the bat bomb for four reasons. Number one, bats are available in large numbers. There are four caves in New Mexico alone, and each are believed to be the home to millions of bats. Bats can carry more than their own weight in flight, up to three times their weight. Bats can hibernate for extended periods without need of food or water. And finally, bats fly in the dark, then find secluded places to hide at sunrise. Well, the program was actually mildly successful, but in a bad way. During testing, some of the bats escaped, resulting in a large part of the base they were being tested at, the Carlsbad Army Auxiliary Base, burning down. And soon, this batty idea was scrapped. My point is, history is filled with incidents of spying with no regard for life. The U.S. has always leveraged the dominant technological systems of the day, whether telegraph, cell phone, satellite, undersea cable, to spy on its friends. Like when in 1862, President Abraham Lincoln gave his Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton, sweeping surveillance power that included, as the New York Times reported, total control of the telegraph lines. Stanton's authority was so vast, he ended up influencing the news that journalists published. Think of that. Or when the United States secretly tracked billions of phone calls made by millions of U.S. citizens in the 1980s and 90s. The program, which enabled the United States to secretly track billions of phone calls made by millions of U.S. citizens over a period of decades, was a blueprint for the NSA surveillance that would come after it. And this takes me back to my discussion of the past 2 weeks about the low-flying Cessna airplanes that house Stingrays, cell site simulators that spoof your cell phone into connecting to it rather than the closest cell tower as a way to once again scoop up your cell phone information. No longer do we need cats or pigeons or bats. We as a society actually embrace and spend big bucks to be spied upon. We have smart meters, Amazon's Echo, the digital assistant device designed to control appliances, locks, lights, and curtains via voice activation. We have doorbells that send pictures to your phone, refrigerators, dishwashers, dryers, televisions fitted with smart technology that can record, save, and transmit your data that can and will be used against you. It happened just recently. In Arkansas, police obtained a search warrant for an Amazon Echo belonging to James Bates in the hopes that the device would cough up voice evidence to suggest that Bates had strangled his friend in a hot tub. The Amazon Echo, like other assistants such as Google Home, provides information when people speak a so-called wake word. The wake word is Alexa in the case of the Echo. And people pose questions like, Alexa, what's the weather? Or commands like, Alexa, play some 80s music. Such questions are not preserved on the device, but are instead stored on internet servers controlled by Amazon and Google. You heard that right. The police seized the Echo device and also asked Amazon to hand over the history of the voice recording related to the device. Amazon reportedly refused. Well, now in the case of Bates, it's unlikely he asked the device, Alexa, how do I dispose of a body? But the police in Arkansas reportedly thought that on the night of the murder, Bates or someone else may have activated the device inadvertently. And if they did, any ensuing recordings might help solve the crime. But in actuality, the arrest was based largely on another spy device, the smart water meter readings they obtained without a warrant from the city of Bentonville, Arkansas's water department. The use of smart meter data by law enforcement to charge someone with murder is a stark example of where violations of privacy can mean the difference between a life of freedom and a life in prison. Court documents show investigators believe that James Bates cleaned up the murder scene because of the amount of water he used in a two-hour window. Police said they got the data from the smart water meter at his home, which, according to the city utilities department, takes a measurement every hour of how much water is used. Police looked at the data and noticed that Bates used an excessive amount of water during the alleged drowning. However, Bates asserts that he can prove he used approximately that same amount of water to fill the hot tub earlier that day. Now, this is a slippery slope indeed. So where am I going with this? Well, just another factual reminder of what has been done in the past, what is being done in the present, with the question in mind, where are we going in the future? How much more will we tolerate, from spying cats to spying home appliances, low-flying spying planes, and our beloved cell phones that we embrace and cherish like our very own child from the womb? Can't be without it for a second. Can't look up, can't look sideways, always head down, oblivious to life around us. Who needs an acoustic kitty when we've happily traded our privacy for a not-so-smart, radiation-emitting cell phone? You are listening to Speak Up Talk Radio, and I am your hostess, Pat Rulo. And today we are taking a look back as a way to understand how and why we find ourselves where we are today. Now, if you know me, you know I am very involved in the patient safety world with my show Speak Up and Stay Alive. And I've done shows on prescription opioids in the past, and I want to talk about those for a few moments today, because we all know that prescription opioids are a menacing health problem. But have we ever thought, how did this come about? Well, while opium itself has been commonly used since at least 3400 BC, heroin is a relatively new invention derived from opium. Heroin was first synthesized in 1874 by chemist Charles Romley Alder Wright, working at St. Mary's Hospital Medical School in London, England. He discovered the drug after playing around with mixing morphine with various acids. 23 years later, a man named Felix Hoffmann, working at pharmaceutical company Bayer in Germany, managed to independently synthesize heroin when he was trying to produce codeine. So Heinrich Dresser, head of the pharmacological laboratory at Bayer, decided they should move forward with it rather than another drug they had recently created, aspirin. And by early 1989, they began the animal testing phase of the product, testing it primarily on rabbits and frogs. They next moved on to testing it on people, primarily workers at Bayer. The workers loved it, some saying it made them feel heroic. Thus the name heroin. And I would say so. Heroin was presented as more or less a miracle drug that was 10 times more effective than codeine as a cough medicine and worked even better than morphine as a painkiller. He also stated that it had almost no toxic effects, including being completely non-addictive. Just 1 year after its release, heroin became a worldwide hit, despite it not actually being marketed directly to the public, but rather simply to physicians. At the end of this first year, it was popularly sold in over 23 countries, with Bayer producing around 1 ton of it that year. Obviously, it quickly became apparent that Bayer's claims of the drug not being addictive were completely false, with reports popping up within months of its widespread release. Despite this, it continued to sell well in the medical field. And finally, in 1913, after the number of heroin addicts began to skyrocket and it became likely that it would shortly be banned in many countries, Bayer decided to stop producing the drug. And the rest is history. Today, there are an estimated 15 to 20 million people who are addicted to heroin. And just as with the surveillance situation, the beat goes on. Pharmaceutical companies are still in it for themselves. For decades, opioid painkillers like oxycodone, hydrocodone, and morphine had been used successfully to treat conditions like intense pain at the end of life or for cancer patients and acute pain after an injury like a broken bone. But everything changed when OxyContin and the marketing campaign that came with it started in the 1990s. The drug, developed by Purdue Pharmacy, had a time-released mechanism that spaced out its effects over a longer period of time. The company sold doctors on the idea that the time-release function made by OxyContin was perfect for a population of patients who were suffering from chronic pain. Representatives also argued that the drug's spaced-out effects made it less likely that the patients would get addicted, which was the main factor deterring many physicians from prescribing opioids for chronic pain. The campaign focused on convincing doctors that they shouldn't worry about addiction, so the medical community was taught to believe that addiction to opiates was relatively rare. By 2001, OxyContin had exceeded more than $1 billion in sales. By 2003, nearly half of the doctors prescribing OxyContin were primary care physicians, according to a 2004 report from the Government Accountability Office. These sales reps received annual bonuses averaging over $70,000, with some bonuses nearing $250,000. Purdue Pharma gave doctors 34,000 coupons for free OxyContin prescriptions, as well as OxyContin fishing hats, stuffed plush toys, coffee mugs with heat-activated messages, music CDs, and luggage tags. Purdue was compiling profiles of doctors and their prescribing habits into databases to pinpoint the doctors prescribing the most pain medications and target them for the company's marketing onslaught. Purdue proudly asserted that the potential for addiction was very small, at one point stating it to be less than 1%. Armed with the time-release formula and misleading statistics about the risk of addiction, Purdue positioned the drug as a relatively safe choice. Sales representatives told some doctors that the drug didn't even produce a buzz, according to USA Today. We now have this incredibly unusual public health crisis that's essentially caused by physicians, caused by the healthcare industry, said the medical director of substance use at the Women's College Hospital in Toronto. And it's also caused by television advertising. If you've watched TV, you know it's insane the number of drug ads on TV. Have you seen the one for pills that alleviate OIC, or opioid-induced constipation? Opioid use, it seems, causes constipation, And the prevalence of those taking opioids has created a sub-market of sorts for a stool-loosening medication to help with the pain pill's side effects. I wonder if any doctors or patients thought that the way to get rid of constipation from opioids is to stop taking opioids. And this, in part, is why people expect and want their doctors to champion opioids. Many will even claim their doctors provided insufficient treatment if they don't walk out of the office with an oxy script in hand. And with federal programs like Medicare and Medicaid using patient surveys as a way to judge care, and with payment structures for doctors and hospitals based on those surveys, having a happy oxy-popping patient matters a good deal to doctors. The CDC is making it perfectly clear that medical practice needs to change because we are harming pain patients and fueling a public health crisis. But people have a way of getting what they want, and the opioid epidemic is evolving. Heroin use is again on the upswing. America's addiction to opioids has survived the government crackdown on OxyContin and returned back to the use of heroin. It's kind of a backwards evolution, with pill users turning to an old 20th century menace that once flourished thanks to the pharmaceutical company Bayer. Well, bottom line, it's time to look up from our phones, pay attention, and speak up. Pharmaceutical companies put profits before public health, and the result is billions for them and broken lives, drug addiction, and death for the American people. One of the best ways to achieve change is to begin small. Start by realizing that you have to look out for your own best interest. Ask questions if your doctor wants to prescribe opiates. Ask, is an opiate necessary? What are the risks? What are the benefits? How long should I take this? Are there any alternatives? What do we hope to accomplish by using an opiate? How will you know when we've met our goal? And ask questions as you advocate for a loved one, especially an elder patient. While there certainly are benefits of opioid use when it comes to pain management with elderly folks, the use does come with risks, and older people really do need someone by their side to pay attention, to ask questions, and to speak up. And speaking up, I'd like to take a moment and share two of my friends with you who air their podcasts on the Speak Up Talk Radio Network, speakuptalkradio.com. Both are no strangers to speaking up. First today is Jana Panaritis, who knows quite a lot about advocating for the elderly because caregiving is her specialty. Here she is.
Hi, I'm Jana Panaritis, host of the AgeWise podcast, where we talk about aging in a different way. We hear from professionals in the field and people like you, unsung heroes caring for family members, friends, and relatives amid the demands of your own life. Join me each week as we laugh, cry, and share. And know you're not alone. Listen to a brand new episode every week at speakuptalkradio.com. To learn more about the show, visit the AgeWise website. That's AgeWYZ.com.
And the next woman who airs on Speak Up Talk Radio is Gina Murphy Darling, who advocates for living clean and green. And as she says, she doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. Take a listen.
Hi there. This is Mrs. Green, and I would love for you to become a part of my world. Mrs. Green's World is an engaged international community and a global movement of ideas and action made up of people who truly care about their own health and the health of this great planet of ours. In Mrs. Green's World, we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. Our guests from all over the world will give you plenty of things to think about. Please visit my website at mrsgreensworld.com and become a part of our world.
Well, these are two wonderful people who see the value in getting out there in an attempt to make this world a better place. Speaking up certainly is the first step to creating positive change. And you can find more powerful hosts and podcasts at speakuptalkradio.com. And earlier I mentioned advocating for elderly patients. It pays to know what hazards to look out for and how to avoid them. And I have a special chapter in my book that's all about the senior scenario. I encourage you to own a copy. It's called Speak Up and Stay Alive, the Patient Advocate Hospital Survival Guide. I cover over 17 different healthcare and hospital hazards that you most likely have never even thought about. And it's only $20 and can be found and purchased on my other website, speakupandstayalive.com. Speakupandstayalive.com. Or you can call me and order by phone, 440-725-5462. That's 440-725-5462. Did you know that over 70 hospitals nationwide are using essential oils to fight germs, improve mood, and reduce stress? I'm Pat Rulo, radio host of Speak Up and Stay Alive, Patient Safety Radio, with a new line of essential oils called Tiny Drops. Now you too can have access to these amazing natural health options. For example, you can use lavender to reduce stress, sweet orange to improve your mood, peppermint to improve focus and energy and alleviate those headaches. Tiny Drops, big results. Visit tinydropseo.com. You are listening to Speak Up Talk Radio, and I'm your hostess, Pat Rulo. So happy that you've joined us today. We've taken a look back and had some very serious topics earlier in the show, and right now I want to lighten things up and share with you, as I do each week, a sneak peek into an author interview that I had on the SpeakUpTalkRadio.com network. And you can hear the entire 30-minute interview at SpeakUpTalkRadio.com. Right now, I have a special author. Her name is Kimberly Kimba Dolfries, and I just know you will love her as much as I do. So here's a little 10-minute peek just to wet your whistle, and I encourage you after the show to head over to SpeakUpTalkRadio.com. On the right-hand side, you will find the recent author interviews. You'll find her there, and I hope you tune in. So here we go. Welcome to the Speak Up Talk Radio Network. I am your hostess, Pat Rulo. We bring you hand-selected hosts, podcasts, and talk radio programming with listening options, 24/7 streaming, or listen on demand. We also feature one-on-one segments with important guests, people who have something to say that you need to hear. And if you have something to say and would like to be featured on the network, please visit speakuptalkradio.com for all of the details, or contact us at PR@speakuptalkradio.com. And right now, I just know we have a fun-loving guest with us. She is Kimberly Kimba Dolfries. Kimba, as she likes to be called, is a former Justice Department official whose publications, until recently, focused on criminal and juvenile justice issues. She's written on a variety of topics, including girls in the juvenile justice system, disproportionate minority confinement, community safety and mobilization, and law enforcement leadership. While at the National Crime Prevention Council, her responsibilities included the publication of the annual report, Mobilizing the Nation to Prevent Crime, Violence, and Substance Abuse. And on the flip side, she is a native Floridian who pretends to be a Virginian. And she's an accomplished king salmon slayer, estate sale junkie, and sometimes writes books, including I Was in Love with a Short Man Once and Magic Fishing Panties. I told you it's going to be fun. She's also had a limerick published in the Washington Post, which she emphatically claims as a legitimate publication cred. And you can find her hanging out in The Middle-Aged Cheap Seats, her blog. You can find that at kimdolfries.com/blog or visit her at kimdolfries.com. And obviously, we have someone whose writing history spans from serious issues to humor. So let's meet her. Welcome to the show, Kimba.
Hi, Pat. Nice to be here.
Oh, it's nice to have you here. We're going to have a good time. I'd like to know right off the top, what is it like being a crazy Southern Irish and a gal?
What a great opening question. So the gal's kind of obvious. Biologically, born yep. Girl, a gal. But the term gal comes from, I'm not quite abroad. I'd like to be abroad. I call myself like abroad in waiting. Like they're great broads in history, Mae West and Shirley MacLaine, and I kind of aspire to be them, but I don't think I've quite reached that level yet. Southern being that I was born and raised in Florida, which many people don't equate with being in the South, but it actually is the southernmost part of the country, so we are allowed to be included in the South. But I've been in Virginia for 2 decades, so hopefully they'll adopt me also as a Virginian. And the crazy part is interesting because I equate crazy with being lighthearted and funny and sort of a little bit getting in trouble. But I've had to be careful because some people equate that term with mental illness, and I certainly don't, you know, in any way, shape, or form want to offend anybody with that term. But you know, in the South, we make jokes that we celebrate crazy, and we actually, like, take it out on the front porch and introduce it to everybody. So crazy, to me, is a term of endearment for outgoing, loquacious, fun, energetic, a little bit get into troublemaker. So that's where those, universally, that's where those terms come from when I describe myself.
I like it. I like it. I think I'm a little bit crazy as well. That's why I was attracted to you. Let's delve then into your two book collection. I Was in Love with a Short Man Once and Magic Fishing Panties. Together, these two books offer descriptive and colorful essays on subjects such as getting a tattoo in midlife, which you and I talked about before we went on air, unique uses for kitty litter, which I have 11 cats. I can learn from that. Handling a rabid bat, public speaking gone wrong, and naked. You say naked. I say naked. Naked hot tubbing in Vegas. So tell us about these two books.
With that in mind, so the first one that I refer to as Short Man, that really came about, honestly, it got started with a conversation about my Nana's apple pie recipe.
Oh.
And here's how. When Nana died, she was an incredibly gifted scratch baker. And by scratch, I mean, you know, nothing from a box, made everything from scratch. And she really had an incredible apple pie recipe in her head. But she never wrote it down. So after Nana passed, we have spent years arguing about what was in Nana's apple pie recipe. I mean, family arguments over this and contests, and my dad and my uncle arguing on whether or not too much cinnamon, not enough cinnamon, if it includes lemon juice. And I thought, wow, if Nana had just written it down, we'd have this. And that's what got me thinking about writing down family stories, and in particular, for Short Man, stories about my son. Mm-hmm. My son, Jimmy, is an only child, and he doesn't have anybody to compare oral history with the way that big families do. Mm-hmm. I mean, even when my family gets together on Thanksgiving, isn't this true for your family? You tell the same story
right. Over
and over again.
Yes.
And from an outsider looking in, they're like, oh, for love of God, you told this story about Uncle Tommy falling into the well 14 times, but you keep retelling it because you want it. It's human beings want to preserve that history. And it occurred to me that I wanted to make sure that my relationship with Jimmy, especially when he was young, I wanted to sort of codify it. And so there's quite a few stories in the Short Man book that are about what I call Jimmy stories. And that's more of a gift to him so that he at least sees how I remember them.
Mm.
And so that it sort of puts it in perspective. Now, Magic Fishing Panties is a little bit different. So Short Man is really about Jimmy, family, relationships, and, quite frankly, some of my memories of childhood and growing up in Florida. Because growing up in Florida in the 70s, wild.
That's all you have to say, yeah.
Yeah. So, so some of those stories are encapsulated in the book as well. Now, the Magic Fishing Panties is a little bit of a twist. Magic Fishing Panties came about 4 years later in 2015. By then, I had joined Club 50. So, you know, firmly in midlife, I've been introduced to the menopause fairy, who is not anybody's friend, but she's every woman has to meet her sooner or later. And the second book is more about my relationships with my gal pals. With my, you know, the women that sustain me and have kept me going for decades. The impetus behind that, so how Nana's apple pie recipe really got Short Man going, with Magic Fishing Panties, believe it or not, and I'll probably get in trouble and you'll have to edit this out later, it was from watching an episode of Keeping Up with the Kardashians. And I was watching it, Pat, and I'm like, real women don't behave this way, or like the housewives of New Jersey or Atlanta or one of those other crazy ones. They just don't. Like women who are friends, for life, they don't treat each other this way. Mm-hmm. And it is frustrating and upsetting to me that portrayal is what will be kept in history, right? Like
Yes. Television
is forever, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want 100 years from now for the historians to be watching those shows and say, oh, well, this is the way women treated each other. No, it's not. I mean, and no offense to them. They have a great big empire. Snaps to them, right?
Right.
But that's just not what we value. So the second book really has stories about what we value as women and how we support each other and take care of each other. And it has some other relationship stories as well, but that's primarily the focus of Magic Fishing Panties.
Well, bravo for you for thinking that way and bringing out the real side of it. Well, where can folks then go to learn more about you, get more of your advice, and where they can purchase your books?
There are a couple of ways you can purchase my books. One, of course, is Amazon. Everybody's bookseller's best friend. I actually also sell my books through my website. So if you'd like to order one from me directly and have me sign it or inscribe it any way you want and mail it to you, www.kimdalfries.com. And on that site, you can see there's an icon at the top where you can order my books. It's also currently available through Barnes & Noble, and they are available for Kindle download.
Okay. All right. So the website is kimdalfries.com. Let me spell it. It's KIMDALFERES. KimDalfries.com. Kimba, I love you.
I love you too, Pat.
I don't know how else to end this. And I might leave it at that. So thank you for today.
Great. Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Wow. Once again, we're out of time. I don't know how that happened so quickly, but we are not out of plenty to talk about. So come back next week. We're also online at iHeartRadio. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes or just visit two websites, speakupandstayalive.com or speakuptalkradio.com. Well, I'm happy you shared today with me, and I hope you come back next week. So until then, I hope you have a healthy and a happy week, free from acoustic kitties and bat bombs. I am your hostess, Pat Rulo, the voice for informed choice.